please welcome our next speakers, Joseph and Ilya, who will be talking about how bootloaders are broken and how to sort of look into them. Please give them a warm round of applause.
Hello, does this sound okay? Okay, cool. Welcome to Boot to Root, auditing bootloaders by example. I'm Joseph Tartaro. I hack things for IOActive, and this is my second time at Congress, so I'm really excited to be back here.
Hi, I'm Ilya. This is my 18th or 19th time at Congress. Happy to be back here, too. I've spoken here, I think, 7 or 8 times before, and I'm very excited to speak here together with Joe. We've been working together on bootloaders the last year and change, and this is, minus the NDA covered stuff, this is some of the things we've observed and seen, so I'm very excited to do this.
The expected audience for this talk would be embedded systems engineers, security people who are interested in embedded systems, and just curious security people. Just a caveat, we're going to be quickly going through about like 70 slides or so, and a lot of it's just like examples of C source code. So if you did not realize you were signing up for an hour of that, feel free to walk out. We're not going to be offended. And then another caveat would be this isn't really trying to flex and show, look at all the bugs we found. The purpose of this was to kind of show people, hey, if you have not looked at bootloaders before, this is our recommended areas of attack surface that are interesting. This is probably where you should get started. And then some examples of nobody's really looking at them, and they should start. So that's pretty much what's going to go on right now. So quickly, here's the agenda. We'll discuss quote-unquote bootloaders, why they're important, some of the common ones we looked at, attack surface, and our conclusions. So there's going to be a wide interpretation of bootloader. So basically what we mean by that is anything that's in your secure boot chain. And if you don't have experience with these or you haven't looked at them much, you can kind of think of it like from an operating system standpoint of user land calling into kernel space. You'll have like kind of normal world calling it to secure world and stuff, and that's kind of what you're looking for is those pivots and when they're processing, attacker user controlled data. So why? Because they're critical for security. It's a key component of your chain of trust, and it's very obvious that a lot of device designers are poor at hardening and limiting attack surface. And what we mean by that is a lot of the devices we've looked at over the last year or so, you'll find devices that have like full network stacks, even though they don't need a network stack. You'll have a bunch of code loaded up to handle file systems that are never expected. So it doesn't really make sense why they're not limiting all that attack surface. There's also a huge underestimate of reverse engineering. People just kind of assuming that there's no bad actors and nobody's really going to look at this thing, and it's this hidden black box that we should ignore. And a little story behind the presentation is we're actually on a train going to a baseball game. I was trying to introduce Ilya to the lovely game of baseball. And we were talking about U-Boot, and I pulled out my phone, and we went to the U-Boot GitHub, and in about, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, we ran into like 10 bugs, and we went, yeah, we should probably audit some of this stuff. And inspiration from a previous talk that Ilya has given at Congress where he audited a bunch of different BSDs, I said, why don't we look at a bunch of different bootloaders? And just to give credit where credit's due, we are not the first to look at any of this stuff. So this is a list of people that kind of inspired us, have done really interesting work. And we recommend if you're interested in any of this and you enjoyed it, you should go check these people out and see things that they've released in papers and stuff like that. So where are they? Bootloaders are pretty much in everything. You have your workstations, phones, game consoles, your TV, everything. And generally, the security basically depends on this. So it obviously really, really, really matters. And so with that said, we basically started looking at these common open source bootloaders. So, you know, U-Boot, Core Boot, Grub, CBIOS, Cafe, which is Broadcom, iPixie, and Tiano Core. And we're just looking at what's on GitHub, what we downloaded. Obviously, in your real-world scenarios, the devices that you have at home or go buy and start looking at, they're going to be heavily modified. They're going to have weird custom drivers that aren't available, things like that. So, you know, we're not here to argue the likelihood of some of the bugs we found. We're not going to argue exploitability. Half of them, we don't know if they're exploitable.
We will for one.
Yeah, we will for one. We don't really that's not really the point of it. The point is to kind of show people, show designers what they should be concerned with, and show interesting or researchers that might be interested what they should look at. So U-Boot is extremely common. It's in a ton of devices. There's a huge, very customizable config for all different sorts of boards and stuff. There's concerns for environment variable stuff. There's a super powerful shell. So you'll sometimes see even shell injection concerns based on environment variables. It's pretty funky, and there's lots of drivers for tons of devices. So it's kind of a great like first step of looking at something that kind of covers a huge breadth of things. And so features of U-Boot that are interesting would be, you know, network stack for different protocol parsing, file systems, and they also will load their next stage images from like all sorts of weird like archaic things that nobody uses anymore. And it's just used by tons of devices. And then Core Boot, and I apologize, this is a little dry right now. We'll eventually get to stuff, but Core Boot, you know, it's more targeted towards modern operating systems. There aren't like legacy BIOS support. It actually, they took a methodology that other projects don't, which is they're not going to implement features that they don't want to. So if you're trying to do network booting or something, you use Core Boot to boot into like iPixie or something. They're not going to implement that feature. These are used in Chromebooks, and obviously some of the interesting parts are come from Google. And one main interesting area is SMM. And then Grub, obviously you guys are all familiar with this. The primary concern here is multi-boot spec, and they support just a ton of file systems, so that's obviously the attack surface you'd be concerned with. But the interesting part here is that there are UEFI-signed versions of Grub. So that's kind of like your secure boot break right there. If you find a vulnerability that's an assigned version, you can now load that into your UEFI and exploit that vulnerability, and you're good to go. And then CBIOS is the default BIOS for Kimu KVM. This supports legacy BIOS stuff, so you'll see that this gets booted into from things like Core Boot. This supports TPM communication, so that's kind of interesting. And it's the compatibility support module for UEFI and OVMF. So, and then Broadcom Cafe. So this is used in a ton of different like network devices and TVs and stuff like that. And the obvious attack surface there would be network protocols, the network stack. That's what you'd want to look at. iPixie, this would be more network-based stuff, various parsing, and similar to Grub, there's UEFI-signed versions. So it's a great potential pivot for secure boot stuff. And then finally, Tiano Core. There's really no introduction needed here. There's been a ton of great presentations over the last like 15 years of people just you know, doing everything to this thing. And due to that, since it's pretty much the most scrutinized one out there, it's really mature compared to everything else. So when you bash Tiano Core, realize that it's way better than everything else. So, and there's a lot of like implementations built on top of it, like platform-specific stuff, Qualcomm's ABL and XBL, things like that. So you'll have all these, you have the base Tiano Core EDK2, and then you'll have all the custom stuff built on top. And then related to bootloaders, you have things like TrustZone, and that's kind of where I mentioned you have like normal world and secure world. You'll have these interesting pieces of code that are running into those secure areas that you're going to want to look for pivots into there so you can gain access to secrets. And then and obviously from the host operating system, the attack surface there would be you can modify things like NVRAM. So you can set variables that when the next time you reboot, the bootloader is going to process those variables. So. And this slide's more for reference. Later, you can get the slides or take a picture or something. These are just links to some instructions for building and whatnot. So if you wanted to start looking at these, you can quickly build a little environment and poke around. So really quickly to go through, the concept of secure boot, you kind of have your chain of trust. You'll have the boot ROM that will then verify and load various other loaders that then verify and load the next thing. And you'll sometimes have a TPM involvement. You'll have some trust zone involvement and then OS interaction stuff like the OS basically setting things like NVRAM, which will set, configuration stuff, whatnot. So the boot ROM itself is something you've probably seen the talk by Cordy Oriup, I think earlier it was. It's really important because it can't be patched. It's a hardware revision would be required if a vulnerability is found, and it's so early in the stage, and you would basically compromise everything after it, that is where you'd want to go. It's extremely bare minimum. It does some initialization of hardware and memory stuff, and then you'll find things like maybe implementations of fastboot, so you have a USB stack, so that's an obvious attack surface you'd be interested in. And then it will verify the signature of the next stage and then boot that. And then you move on to the next stages, and this is where they start initializing the rest of what's necessary, network stacks, SMM handlers, and whatnot, and they'll basically just keep handing off. And then you'll run into things like trusted boot and measure boot, which is, verification and then measuring, which is kind of more for logging and whatnot. Doesn't actually mitigate anything. It just kind of alerts you of stuff. So... Some hardware environments are a little different, like the secure world stuff. You'll have ARM with TrustZone. Windows has VTL0, VTL1, hypervisor stuff. And then, I'm basically repeating myself. And then eventually the operating system. That's going to get, the kernel's going to be loaded, it's going to be verified, and then eventually start running, and then you can have fun. So early observations is everything we pretty much looked at that's open source, there's no privilege separation. So if you were to compromise a piece of component, you pretty much rule everything. And what's interesting is there are some proprietary bootloaders that you're starting to see, like Apple, for example. They're doing some aspect of privilege separation. So if you were to exploit a portion, you didn't necessarily control the world. And so right now, at least all the stuff we looked at did not have anything like that, but maybe in the future we'll see that. So this is the list of the attack surface that we think people should be interested in and focusing on. You have NVRAM, file systems and files, all network stack protocol stuff, all various buses, SMM, DMA, and hardware stuff. The interesting thing about buses that we've noticed is that embedded designers seem to inherently trust anything that an end user should never interact with. So they go, okay, an end user uses USB, so we should verify some of that, but they do a bad job. An end user doesn't play with the spy flash, so just inherently trust it. Or an end user isn't the TPM, so just if the TPM says something, run with it, and they mess it up a lot. So NVRAM, these are the various environment variables that can be configured for the next boot cycle. And like I said, it's basically processing of user-controlled data. So if you start looking at some of these bootloaders, here's the interesting functions you'd want to look at. For example, in uBoot, you just kind of call for environment git and grep through, and you see them grabbing the environment variable and see what they do with it. If they're not doing any sort of validation, you're going to hit a bug. And so an example of that would be right here. You see there's an environment git for boot p vci. It checks if it existed. It will then do a stir length and then just memcopy it directly into a buffer without validating that it can fit the buffer. And this is actually kind of funny. Earlier today, we were like, we should try to exploit one of these just to show it. So we toyed with this one and, you know, just threw a bunch of bytes, and it starts just kind of sending these weird packets over the wire and a bunch of BOOTP stuff. You'll see later on, you just have full raw packets of whatever payload we send. But it wasn't very realistic. It kind of started getting into like the Kemu like network implementation stuff. So we kind of avoided it and moved on to a different bug. But as you can see, it's very, very easy for you to start looking at this stuff and being interested in it and quickly set up an environment and mess with exploitation. And we'll get into it, but there's no mitigations. So as you see, there's a bit of a pattern here. Environment get host name, memcopy with stir length. No checks. 128 byte buffer, environment get with boot dev, stir copy. Boot file, stir copy. You know, it just keeps happening. This is kind of what we were talking about. It's just the quality code is not very great. What's funny is when we were messing with that BOOTP VCI stuff earlier this morning, we went, this is going to be more involved. So Ilya was like, well, let me just go find a different bug. You know, 10 minutes later, he's like, I found a different stack smash. Okay, let's work on that one. This is a perfect example. The environment get the variable, then they'll grab the very first element of that variable as a length, and then they use that as a length. And, yep. And it keeps happening. So just a quick example. See this. So the attack scenario of this would be, you have a device, you have NVRAM that you can physically modify because you have physical access. And this is kind of an example of the default NVRAM. So we just threw, you know, an environment variable with 600 bytes, and you'll see towards the bottom there's 4 bytes where we threw a function in there, and that's the address. So this had to do with the JFFS2 file system loading. So you just do FS load, and it's done. So,
that's shellcode being executed.
So this is. Sorry, I can't see. So obviously, if you've never looked at this stuff, it's kind of fun to play around with, and you should start poking at it, because why not? And screenshot.
Sweet. Cool. Work. Okay. Cool. So that was the NVRAM attack surface, which is usually the most fun to play with. Programming the spy flash sometimes may take a little bit of fiddling, but in terms of attack surface and fun things to play with, it's you know, as Joe said, often overlooked, and so it's easy to toy with. And so you saw all this sprintfs and mem copies and string copies. There's a lot of fun there. But obviously, there's not just NVRAM. There's more attack surface to a trusted boot environment. And obviously, one of them is the file system, right? Because this thing needs to boot, and it needs to find images, and they're stored somewhere, and your file system sort of brings order to that chaos. And so basically, you need to mount your file system. And often, file systems are not signed or integrity checked, or not all of it is. Because before you can do that, you need to be able to read something, right? An example of a common file system would be the FAT file system. If you know, if your boot environment supports loading your USB drive, and for storage, it's probably going to be FAT. Depending on, and the flash itself may have its own proprietary format, or it may use X2 or you know something else. But clearly, the file system parsers, I mean, that's prime attack surface. Closely related is obviously the files inside of your file system, right? Now, depending on what your boot environment looks like, some of these files are going to be integrity checked, but some of them might not be, right? And so those file parsers are interesting attack surface. And if you're either looking for bugs or you're building a product, we would highly recommend fuzzing these. And it's like starting with AFL is probably a good starting point. But we'll show some examples of some bugs we saw in a number of bootloaders. So we'll cover X2. We'll cover a bitmap splash parsing one. I think the other ones are just sort of examples of where there could be bugs, but those two we'll cover. So this is Grub, and this is Grub X2. And Grub X2, you know, this is the symlink code. So it looks at the file system, and it goes, oh, okay, this is a symlink. How do I parse a symlink? And so the symlink says, hi, I'm a symlink. I'm this big. And what Grub does is, oh, great, I'll allocate that much size, but I'll do one more for null bytes. And, of course, that is a classic integer overflow. And the Grub memory allocator actually returns a valid pointer for a zero size. So this is a perfect primitive. So you get a pointer to something that is of zero size. And then it actually reads the symlink content from the file system into a zero size buffer. And obviously, that's going to cause memory corruption. And a primitive, you can't see it here, but a primitive is really nice because that particular read function actually, if there's not much more than disk, it stops reading. So even though you can say read 4 gigs, you can make the layout so it only reads, let's say, 1,000 bytes or 100 bytes. And so you have this near perfect primitive to cause memory corruption. This wasn't Tiana Core, for example. This was the bitmap splash screen parser. And I don't know if you know anything about bitmap internals. It's a very simple format, but basically you can have a 4-bit bitmap, and that gives you a palette of 4x4, which is 16 bytes. And so the idea is if you have a 4-bit bitmap, then it has a 16-byte palette, and so it goes and reads that 16-byte palette, except you tell it how big the palette is, and you can say, okay, I know you're expecting a 16-byte palette, but I'm giving you a 256-byte palette, and it'll read it into a 16-byte buffer. so that was broken, and then for the 8-bit bitmaps, similarly, it was broken the same way. And this is just the tip of the iceberg. There are many, many, many more. This did not take long to find. But let's move on. Obviously, okay, now that we've looked at some local stuff and some physical stuff, what about remote? You know, what is there, right? Obviously, if you're talking remote in the modern world, you're talking TCP/IP, right? So you need a TCP/IP stack, and you need to have some services that you either expose or that you have client code for that you go talk to, right? And that's BootP and DHCP and DNS and iSCSI and NFS. And if you're in a corporate, if you're a corpnet, you probably want to have IPsec and then HTTP and HPS and TFTP, right? Sure enough, you know, most bootloaders have code for this. And then you start asking, okay, well, what's the attack surface? For TCP/IP, if you implement your own stack, good luck, because you're going to screw it up. But secondly, it's like, okay, well, if you look at these things, you take a step back and say, okay, well, really, this is all mostly TLV parsing. And so you go and look into, like, what are the things that can go wrong if you do TLV parsing. And, you know, there'll be out-of-bound reads pretty much everywhere, and you'll see endless loops in lots of places and things like that. If you look at the protocols on top of that, like DHCP and DNS, you have sort of your standard sort of network attacks where you'll see like lease stealing or cache poisoning or things like that if you don't protect your ID. So if you have a static ID or you don't validate your IDs or you generate predictable IDs, you know, you can have these kind of poisoning, stealing, man-in-the-middle attacks, right? Thirdly, the thing we really like to see is memory corruption bugs. You know, at the end of the day, you take network data and you parse it, and if you do it wrong, you may cause memory corruption bugs. Another sometimes overlooked interesting bug, I think, when you're doing network parsing is when you have information leaks. So this often manifests itself. I mean, Heartbleed, of course, was one example. It was a perfect primitive. But generally, it'll be this thing where, you know, you end up generating some kind of packet as a response to something, and, you know, you'll have done a memory allocation, but for some reason not initialized something, and so you end up sending uninitialized data over the network. So this is sort of the common things you see in network stacks in general. So if you are looking for these kind of bugs in a boot environment, or if you are building a product that does this, I would highly recommend Fuzzingham. There are numerous interesting network fuzzers. If you're looking for network stack fuzzing, I would recommend ISIC. It's pretty old, but it's still incredibly, incredibly effective. It tends to break most network stacks. So with that said, let's show some examples. I was so U-boot, for example, this is the U-boot DNS code, and if you see that, that's the TID, that's the DNS ID, and it's basically they use the static DNS ID of 1 for all DNS packets that they send out. So doing DNS man in the middle on a U-boot environment is extremely trivial. You guess the DNS ID by saying that it's 1, and you are correct 100% of the time. So this is Broadcom's coffee, and this is the DHCP parser, and it basically has this sort of this junk stack buffer where it just needs to read something out of a buffer, and it goes and says, okay, well, get me the length of that thing, and it's a uint 8, so that means it can represent 0 up till 255, and then it reads 0 up until 255 into that junk buffer. So that's a stack corruption right there. If you then look at the coffee a TFTP parser, it's very similar, where in this case it has a 512-byte buffer, and then it basically copies the entire RX buffer into it, and this is for Ethernet, so up to 1,500 bytes gets copied into this 512-byte buffer, again, causing memory corruption. Obviously, we're not done with coffee yet, because it has such beautiful code. So this is the coffee ICMP ping handler, and this has this really cute sort of use after free bug or double free, where it basically sends out a ping, and then it sits there receiving. You see the while loop there, and it basically sits there receiving packets until it finds the right one. But it also, because it doesn't want to have an endless loop, it has a timeout. And there's this interesting condition where if the last thing it looked was the packet you were looking for, but it also timed out at the exact same time, it frees that packet twice, which obviously can lead to memory corruption. Again, we're not done with coffee yet. There we go. Not done with coffee yet. So this is the IP handler in coffee. And if anybody has ever looked at an IP header, which I would assume most of you have, you'll know it has an IP header length and a total length. Of course, coffee needs to know this because it needs to know where stuff is. But coffee validates neither the IP header length or the total length. So once you start messing with those, coffee blows up really fast. So that was sort of a quick overview of all the trivial TCP and TCP-related bugs that show up in your average bootloader. But let's say you got that covered, and let's say, you know, okay, what's the next thing? What more sort of network stuff can we do? And then, of course, what comes to mind is Wi-Fi, you know, 802.11. A surprising number of bootloaders don't have 802.11. So I don't know if that's sort of on purpose, or just sort of we didn't get to having this feature yet, but we will at some point. And obviously, it'll have bugs when we implement it. We did find one that has it, and I'll get to that in a second. One thing I did want to mention is that if you look at 802.11, like frame parsing, depending on which device you have, and particularly which radio your device is using, that you'll have radios that do a lot of parsing on the radio, in which case the stack is kind of covered because it's, or at least you hope it is, where the radio does a bunch of validation. But then there's a whole bunch of radios that sort of, you know, they take packets from the wire and they just don't do anything and just pass it on to the OS. That's the stuff that's interesting from attack surface point of view if you're looking to attack the bootloader and not the firmware. We looked at iPixie, and of course, you know, anytime you do any kind of Wi-Fi stuff, the first thing you do is you're looking for an SSID, right? This is what this thing does. And, you know, it sort of has this SSID buffer, which an SSID can be up to 32 bytes. So that is 32, well, it's 33 bytes because it's 32 plus 1. And it has this loop where it sort of goes over IEs that it gets. And then when it finds the right the IE for an SSID, it says, okay, we'll take this IE and we'll do IE length. And IE length is a uint 8, so it can be up to 255. And it copies the SSID IE into the SSID buffer, which is only 32 bytes, causing memory corruption. That's iPixie for you. The next one, if you're thinking networking, would be Bluetooth. And Joe and I have actually, we've looked at proprietary bootloaders that have Bluetooth support. Unfortunately, we can't talk about those bugs because they're covered by non-disclosure agreements. And we tried really, really hard to find a similar equivalent in any kind of open source bootloader, and we couldn't find one. So unfortunately, we can't give examples of sort of Bluetooth bugs in open source bootloaders. But I do kind of want to, in general terms, talk about what we have seen and where we suspect the bugs are going to be if somebody does do this in an open source bootloader or somebody implements a new bootloader. And also, if you're going to do Bluetooth in a bootloader, it's usually for, you know, HID device, right? This is for keyboard and mouse. This usually ends up being for consumer devices. But in general, if you look at a Bluetooth stack and you're looking for any kind of, you know, parsing bugs, there's three sort of recurring themes that we saw when we looked at the Bluetooth stacks that we have. And this is if you look at the lower layers like L2P cap and things like that. And this is usually related to frames and frame lengths. So very, very large frames. So a frame can be up to about 65,000 bytes because the length is a UN16. And so if you create really large frames, like right up to the edge, that tends to blow up Bluetooth stacks. The other one is if you create very, very, very short frames, less than what something is expecting, that tends to blow up your Bluetooth stack. And then lastly, because L2 cap can have fragmentation, so you can have individual little fragments that you all add together, and every fragment can be X amount of bytes, but the whole thing can be up to 65,000 number of bytes. So if you start playing around with the fragmentation, numerous Bluetooth stacks have blown up. Again, I wish I could have shown an actual bug here, but I wasn't able to find any in the open source bootloaders. So moving on to USB, this is a prime attack surface in bootloaders, obviously. If you haven't followed the news in the last couple of weeks and months, this has shown up in a number of devices. This is, at least up until recently, I think was sort of underreported or sort of people didn't quite care about it. But to me, the USB stack is like anytime I look at a USB loader, at a bootloader, my first thought is, you know, NVRAM and number two is USB, right? And USB is interesting because obviously a lot of bootloaders support USB because they'll use it either for storage or, you know, things like Ethernet dongles, but often for storage. Either you expose certain files or you try to do some kind of recovery boot from USB or something like that, right? Basically, if you start looking at how USB works at a slightly lower level, it's not quite, like, it's not like PCI. It's more packet-based. What happens, when a device talks to a host, the device is asked for quote-unquote descriptors. And these descriptors say certain things about your device. And based upon the number of descriptors that the host asks from you and all the answers you give them in descriptor responses, the host can then figure out, like, what kind of device you are and, like, what class you are and what functionality you expose and all these kind of things. A lot of these descriptors end up, you know, being parsed and being parsed wrong. Generally, we often see either straight-up overflows or double fetches. Because the way descriptors work is they're variable-length content, but the headers are predefined. And the way it works is you first ask for the header, and then based on the length of the header, you ask for the thing again, except the USB protocol doesn't allow you to just get the payload, you have to reread the whole thing, so you have to reread the header that you already had. And so in most implementations, what happens is you go get the header, you allocate a buffer, and then you go get the header and payload again, and you overwrite the original header, which means is you get to overwrite the original header length. And so you can have a toctile where your device gives you a header with a good length, and then the second time it gives you a descriptor with a bad length, and if your host doesn't validate that both lengths are the same, bad things happen. Straight up overflows happen too, because nobody ever expects the USB device. There's an example in Grub, for example, where it goes and gets a descriptor, and the descriptor says, oh, here's my config count. I have this number of configurations. Go and fetch those in the descriptor as well. There is a predefined array of number of configurations that Grub has, and it doesn't correlate that with the config count. It just always assumes the config count is less to or equal to the array. And so if you have a malicious device and you say, hey, I know you're erased 32 bytes, 32 elements, but I'm going to give you 64 configurations, it'll happily write 64 configurations in a place that can only hold 32 of them. And exactly the same thing for number of interfaces. Tiana Core had similar bugs where this was Tiana Core where they go and get a descriptor, and then the descriptor length says, okay, now go fetch me the whole thing and use that descriptor length. Except the original hub descriptor was a very small struct, and the descriptor length is a uint 8, so it can send up to 255 bytes, and so that would have smashed memory and caused a stack corruption. And so as you can see here, the fix here wasn't actually at a bound check, but just to make the buffer bigger, because you know the length is uint 8, so if you just make the buffer 256, then any length you give it will... will fit within the buffer. Hold on. Yeah, this is an example in CBIOS, where this is the classic double fetch, where it goes and gets the header, does an alloc based on the header, and then gets the header again with the content, and it doesn't verify that config wtotal length is the same thing as cfg wtotal length. And because that verification isn't there, whoever calls this thing can no longer trust wtotal length because it could be invalid. And so as I said, USB to me is one of the prime attack surfaces to secure boot. And so I want to sort of very, very briefly mention two recent real world cases where devices got broken into because of USB parsing into bootloader. So this is a case of the Nintendo Switch, the Tegra. This was done by the Failoverflow people about a year or so ago. That basically, you know, you give it a length that's not validated, and then a mem copy, and that causes memory corruption. And then the recent iPhone Checkmate, this is slightly more complicated because it wasn't a straight-up memory corruption, but it was, you know, if you fiddle around enough with the state, it sort of gets out of sync, and it has all these pointers that it's still considered to be alive, but the memory's been freed. And so this ends up with a user after free, but it is because of a sequence of USB packets that are being sent. Right, so that's it for USB. Obviously, a bunch of the buses, or almost any bus on your device, if your boot chain uses it, is interesting attack surface. And this is SpyFlash shouldn't be trusted, SDIO, I2C, LPC, even your TPM, right? Even your TPM response you get back from TPM can't be trusted because somebody could deinstall your TPM and pretend to be your TPM. And if you don't now validate the data you get from TPM, you end up with memory corruption. So this is, for example, what happened in CBIOS. CBIOS has this talks to the TPM, and it goes and gets this structure, and you can send it less than what it expects. And then basically they subtract some side of a struct minus less what they expect, and so that causes integer underflow, which ends up with a really big size. And then that size is given to malloc. And malloc internally has an int overflow. So that really big size then becomes a very small size. And then they copy into it. And that causes memory corruption. So this is a combination of two bugs, right? One is where the sizes are wrong. And then secondly is where the malloc has an internal integer overflow. And this is the malloc internals of CBIOS, which I don't want to dive into now because it's pretty convoluted and complex. I'll leave this as an exercise to the audience to figure out where the int overflow is. And technically, it's not an int overflow because it's a bunch of shifting being done, but it essentially comes down to an int overflow. Yeah, there we go. Tap. Oop. Yep, there we go. Okay. So another surface, attack surface that is interesting, but... often overlooked on devices, except for UEFI, is system management mode. And I mean, there have been, over the last decade and a half, numerous presentations about SMM attack surface and breaking SMM handlers for UEFI, because it's an x86 thing, and you see this in UEFI stacks. And it was a sort of cat and mouse game where for years, you know, somebody breaks something and then UEFI fixes it, and then somebody breaks it again and UEFI fixes it again, and somebody breaks it again and UEFI goes, okay, let's do a mitigation for this. And this has gone on for like 15, 16 years. And occasionally people still find bugs, but by and large, UEFI does fairly well now with regards to SMM handling. There's some third-party stuff that still breaks occasionally, but in general, they got a handle on this. Now, what if you're using x86, but you re-implement your own bootloader and you don't use Eufy, right? Well, that means you're going to run into all the same problems Eufy had, and you're going to screw it up in all the same ways, and it'll take you another 15 years to get it right. But I guess if you were to try it the first time, this is what Coreboot does. And to their credit, they say, oh, we get input, we should range check it. And their range check says to do. Okay, now I talked about a bunch of buses. The thing to me that sort of separates that from other things is when you do DMA. Generally, for as long as DMA has been around, the idea has been DMA is game over, right? If you get DMA, then you know that's that. There's no trust boundary. Obviously, that's no longer true, right? We have IOMUs, and if you use them, and if you have a device that has this available, then all of a sudden DMA can be stopped, it can be contained, it can be regulated. And so it's no longer a sort of game over and you can implement a trust boundary. A few things there. A, if you are an embedded device and you're using an IOMU, you are way ahead of the curve because not that many people are doing this, right? You should, but it takes some effort. There's obviously many different IOMUs. It depends on your architecture and sort of the board you have and all sorts of things. So Intel's VDD, ARM is SMMU, AMD has like the device exclusion, and it's got a few other ones as well. But basically, if you use one of these, you can sort of, DMA is no longer the game over. That doesn't mean that you know you're in the clear. Once you define DMA as an attack surface, you have to defend it. And that's where you get some difficulty because you'll end up using drivers that have been written before it was a trust boundary. No one has ever written a DMA handler and with a trust boundary in mind because you assume that there's no trust boundary. So now, if you start using the IMU, you have to go back in all your drivers and look at, okay, where am I doing DMA? And now I can no longer trust what's in when I get back from DMA, and you got to go validate all this stuff. But even if you do all of that right, which, by the way, is very hard and you probably won't do it right, but let's say you do. Secondly, because DMA is now a trust boundary, anytime you open up a memory window for a device, you can't just open it up. You have to clear the memory first because otherwise now you're leaking memory to a device, right? So all these sort of new things sort of show up if you take DMA as a trust boundary. And let's say you do that right, well, now you still have a dependency on the IOMU because you are assuming the IOMU is perfect when it probably isn't, right? I haven't really gotten to this part yet, but one of my plans for the future is to go look at IOMUs and see if I can, you know, attack IOMUs and then find bugs there. I strongly suspect there will be side channels and logic bugs and maybe even some heart room implementation bugs. Bug-wise, this is where it sort of gets designy, right? So this is Eufy today, EDK2 platform code, where it has support for IMMU and they're ahead of the curve. But if you look at the spec, there's no good handover protocol from Eufy to the next stage. And so Eufy basically boots up and very early configures the IMMU and makes sure that devices can't peek or poke arbitrary physical memory, and then it does all of its stages, and then it's about to hand off, and it goes, well, I don't know if the next guy supports IMMU, so it undoes all the IMMU program it does, turns the thing off, opens up everything, and then hands it over to the next guy. So you did all this work for nothing. and this is a spec bug, and it's being worked on. People at Intel are very much aware of this. People at Apple have fixed this for their devices. This is going to get fixed in the future, but given that this is done, has to be done by spec, you know, it takes a while because you have to get people to agree to it and then have numerous different implementations implement this. And this is where I hand back over to Joe.
So hardware, it's pretty much out of scope for the presentation. We did not look at any of this, but we thought it would be naive to not at least mention it to people. And what we mean by that are like glitching, side channel, silicon stuff. And so with glitching, you have like fault injections, and a lot of times people go after things like the signature verification stuff. So they'll basically glitch that part, and then they'll start running unsigned code. And a recent example of some glitching was done by Fel Overflow for the PS4 SysCon. And I forget the specifics, it's been a while. Really, really good blog post you should check out. But I think it went to like an infinite loop, like, oh, go to debug mode or something, and it would say, that's not enabled, infinite loop, and then they just glitch out of it, and then it initializes debug mode. And so stuff like that, obviously, should be concerned with. Then clearly side channel with timing discrepancies, power discrepancies, things like Spectre Meltdown, speculative execution in general. These are where people are leaking secrets, right? Going after keys so they can start signing their own code, stuff like that. And then ChipSec, and this is somewhat interesting because it's obviously only relevant for a very sophisticated attacker. It's going to be somebody who has very expensive equipment. They do things like decapping. They use fibs and SEMs. They can do things like optical ROM extraction and get the boot ROM and then start auditing that and then you know, find a bug and exploit it. And obviously totally out of scope for the presentation, but one thing that's interesting about this is kind of presently it's still, you know, not a lot of people have this expensive equipment, but I think very soon you have people like John McMaster and stuff who have like a SEM in their garage, right? And so you're going to eventually start getting these regular hackers in their garage that will eventually get this equipment as the older equipment becomes more affordable, and maybe that opens us up to more realistic instead of people just kind of ignoring it, and they go, eh, I'm not worried about somebody with, you know, $250,000 worth of equipment. Now it's turning into somebody who dropped $10,000 or $15,000. And then, you know, a quick note on code integrity. It's something that people mess up a lot. It's kind of hard to do right. You have people that do weak or crypto. You have blacklist problems, and an example of that is, you know, there's finite space for their blacklist. It'll eventually get exhausted. So when you have stuff like where I mentioned that you have assigned grub, there's a known bug in assigned grub binary that was released by Kaspersky. And if that's not on the blacklist of your UEFI platform at home, you can just load that up and then exploit it, and you just broke Secure Boot. Like, and it's not going to get fixed until that platform has an up-to-date blacklist. And eventually, if all this crap gets blacklisted, eventually that list will be full, and then they can't blacklist anymore. Right? So there's a concern there. And then you'll have issues where they'll only sign like certain portions, not the full blob. So you can you know, still modify certain parts, or sometimes you'll see they'll just check for a signature existing, but they don't validate it. You know, really, really dumb stuff. Conclusions. Obviously, this is the tip of the iceberg. There's a lot of stuff we didn't look at, and if it wasn't clear, we did not really audit these things. We literally would like chat with each other every day and be like, "Hey, we need a CBIOS bug." Like, okay, give me an hour. Okay, got one. Okay, check the box, and then let's move on to the next one. Our goal was to have an example of a bug for each list of the attack surface, an example of a bug for each list of the thing we looked at, and that was it. So, you know, once we found one, we stopped. So you guys should, you know, go hunting and have fun. But if it wasn't obvious, there's a surprising amount of low-quality code. It's kind of crazy. And it's pretty clear that not a lot of people are looking at this stuff. And one thing that kind of sucks is you get to NDA hell really, really, really quick if you want to look at any of this proprietary stuff. So if you're interested in Qualcomm stuff, for example, and you want to get some documentation or look at it, you pretty much have to sacrifice a firstborn to get access to that stuff. Like, it's just not going to happen. And it's kind of silly. You know, kind of like our advice and call to action is you know, people should be minimizing their image, their boot environments, their host environments. You know, turn off features you don't need. If you don't need a network stack, why have it? If you don't need USB, why have it? All you're doing is enabling attack surface for somebody to leverage. And something that we see a lot, which is insane, is like these little embedded devices that are running Linux, and they have literally more drivers than our desktop at home, and it's just like, what is going on here? It doesn't make sense. So you should really, really, really work on limiting the attack surface. And really quick, mitigations.
There aren't any in most environments.
Yeah, there just aren't any. As you can see from the example from before, that was, like, you know, just from this morning, just really quick, you know, smash and, you know, overwrite the stored PC, and that's it. Like, there's no ASLR, there's no anything like that, code flow integrity, whatnot. But there's a link to a GitHub, and that is an Intel employee that has gone and implemented a lot of these mitigations that are moving into Teano Core. So they are way, way, way ahead of the game of everyone else because they're actually getting a lot of these mitigations, which is quite impressive. And you should check it out because it's interesting code. So kind of a call to action. We really hope that this was inspirational to a few of you. If you've never looked at this stuff and it was always this black box that you weren't sure about, you should just start poking around. Go find the slide where we showed where the build instructions were, and go build some of these things and mess around, and you're going to have fun. And like we said, with no mitigations, you can work on some easier exploit dev stuff, and it's cool, right? But it's clear that a lot of people need to be reviewing this because it's clearly not happening. People should start fuzzing interfaces. Everything we kind of showed should have been found with basic fuzzing. We're kind of at a point where I just said, I'm just going to take like a Teensy or something and have it just, you know, do that classic descriptor double fetch, because I think we've seen that in like every USB stack. Like it's just like, just make a device and just start plugging it into stuff and just watch it break. And then obviously periodic reviews and whatnot. But yeah, that's pretty much it. So yeah.
Well, thank you. Now we have about 10 minutes for Q&A. And we will start immediately with the internet.
Thank you. Has the grub issue been fixed yet? And was the code unique to grub or borrowed from, you know, elsewhere?
I don't think it's been fixed yet. And this was from whatever the official grub repository was.
All right, if you have a question in the room, please line up at the microphone so I can see you. And now microphone number two, please.
So let's say you want to make a more secure laptop. So you can take Power Boot, take a static kernel so that everything is compiled in, no modules. But what about the text surfaces that, let's say, somebody tries to interrupt the line of while it is booting, for example, that you maybe somehow get into make a DMA access because you somehow interfere with a, let's say, Broadcom network device that has some special firmware to optimize the traffic or something, and that this thing gets buffer overflowed and makes some problems on the bus or something.
So are you talking about attack surface from devices?
Yes, that's like that. Let's say you want to make a good system, so I think the best you can do if you have a laptop, that you take a Core Boot and you take a Linux, that you completely compile without module support. Everything you want to have is in the static kernel, and then just boots. And the kernel is in the Core Boot, and so mm-hmm. It's in the flash. But you can get problems by let's say some devices that just spit into your memory because they can do a DMA master.
Yeah, that's definitely a concern, and that's one of the things we were like, okay, well if you do use DMA as it has been forever, then it's game over. Luckily nowadays we have IOMUs, so you, depending if which situation you are in and what hardware you have, you can configure your device to use the IOMU. And if you're doing that, then even if a certain hardware device is compromised, you can still try to protect, you know, your CPU and your host from the device by having the IOMU. That I think, I hope it answers your question, but it's about as good an answer as I can come up with.
So this is the maximum you can do against some attacks?
From a device?
Let's say you want to make an extreme hardened laptop that you use in an extreme hostile environment.
Say again?
You want to make a hardened laptop that you use in a hostile environment.
Right. I mean, I think that's the best you can do, right? You can go and look at your host OS and look at how it parses the stuff that comes from the bus, because there'll be bugs there too. But I think that's the best I can come up with.
Yeah, I mean, you minimized the attack surface as much as you can, right? And then once you have it as minimized as possible, then you just kind of hope there's nothing there.
But you don't need the code signing because you have everything in your flash. Or you still need some stuff.
Oh, you mean the stuff that runs on the host?
Let's say you have a core boot on the Linux kernel in the flash.
Uh-huh.
And so everything is like we have, let's say, 8
Can you maybe take this discussion after the talk because we have more questions? Thank you.
Thanks.
Signal Angel, please.
What is your favorite disassembler that you use while reverse engineering the bootloaders?
We just looked at source code.
we used CDB in a few places.
In this particular case,
most of it was white box, so we didn't have much, except for the exploit, we didn't have much need for a disassembler. I guess a little bit of GDB. In general, when we do reverse engineering, IDA's my go-to. I've been playing around with Ghidra a little bit. It looks promising. Has undo, which is nice. those are usually... And then, for doing Linux type stuff, GDB is nice when you're doing debugging. But generally, IDA.
Microphone number one, please.
I have two questions. What's your opinion on the ARM trusted firmware architecture? I have to work with this, and I'm a little bit shocked. In my opinion, it's a little bit overcomplicated. And the second question is, should we not also question the boot ROMs? Because what I've seen in this special project, it leads me to believe that the boot ROM is also very broken.
Mm-hmm.
And then is the question if it's really necessary to harden the other stuff anymore.
Right, yep. Yeah, those are really good questions, by the way. It sounds like you're working on this.
Yes.
Your first question was what again?
What do you think about the ARM trusted
right,
firmware
yes. architecture? I've touched upon it in a few engagements. Unfortunately, any of the concrete stuff I can't really talk about because it was covered by I see you're aware of this problem. But I share your opinion that there are some things in there that are troubling. With regards to the boot ROMs, you are spot on, sir. I mean, we try to bring this up in one of the slides is if there's a bug there, you can't fix it. Hardware revision is the only way to fix it, so you're kind of screwed. There are some designs you can do to try to minimize it. So you could say, okay, well, you can in your boot ROM, you could have a feature that allows for quote-unquote patching the boot ROM where you can have a piece of something on storage that could overwrite what the boot ROM is supposed to do. Obviously, up until that point, whatever's in the boot ROM, still, you can't fix that, but you can minimize the amount of stuff in the boot ROM that's not patchable, but you can't minimize all of it. I mean, there's going to be some of it that is locked, burned in hardware, and can never be fixed for that device. I'd love to hear of a better solution. I don't know of any.
No, I was just going to say, this kind of touches on when we said people underestimating reverse engineering. They kind of just keep it super, super black box, and it's this secret thing. And then, when somebody finds a way to dump a boot ROM, they start looking at it, then they just see, a bug in a USB stack, and then the switch goes down, or the iPhone, or whatever else, right? From my perspective, I would say it would make more sense to do more open auditing and let more eyes see it instead of hiding it in the corner and pretending like, well, it's okay because nobody's looking. That's at least my perspective on it. I know why people are super secretive about it, but you need more eyeballs. So
maybe if you've got the right context, my wish would be to get blank chips so I could flash them with my own boot ROM. So I have a method to improve things and keep the attack surface minimum.
Yeah, and then there's going to be two other ARM dies on there that are circumventing everything that you just did. So, yeah.
Do we have more internet questions?
Yes. Are you aware of any good and maybe even free bootloader fuzzer?
Not in its whole. I mentioned a few places. If you're doing any kind of file-based stuff and you can isolate it, AFL is, you know, that's the go-to these days. For network stuff, there's a couple of interesting ones like ISIC, and there's some Wi-Fi fuzzers, and I think there's, you know, some DNS fuzzers and things like that. So that works.
Yeah, I would say the best way, in my opinion, would be to pull out the interesting components that are doing the parsing and the stuff you're concerned about and write a harness for that. So you don't really need to try to write a fuzzer for that environment. You can just pull that feature out and harness it up and then let it, you know, run on a bunch of cores. And
yeah, so I think libfuzzer might be very helpful there.
Yeah. All right, number two, please.
Hi. Would it help reducing the occurrence of such errors by using another programming language like that would feature more secure things at compile time or during runtime, like maybe Rust?
Mm-hmm.
Would it help? And if yes, are there alternative projects that use other languages other than C?
I'm not aware.
I think you're right. I think we can reduce the amount of, especially the memory corruption stuff. I mean, if you switch to something like Rust, even though I think on occasion there's some Rust corner case that shows up where something doesn't get caught by the verifier, those are weird corner cases. In general, yes, I think you're right. If we switch languages, the memory corruption, a lot of memory corruption stuff goes away, but not everything goes away. All the design stuff is still there, right?
But nobody's currently doing that, though, right?
Well, so there was a talk by Andrea Barisani yesterday or day before, where he's doing a Go runtime for as a base for an ARM device. So this is an avenue that is currently in the beginning of being researched and being worked on. I think it's interesting. I think it's a direction one that we could go into. I think there's something there. At the present time, it still seems a bit too early. And the other thing is that while it does reduce the number of bugs that are going to be there, in particular memory corruption stuff, it doesn't, like, there will still be, you know, your logic bugs and your hardware bugs and things like that. So it's not a silver bullet, but it could definitely help.
Okay, and we're out of time. Please thank our speakers again.